Well, good evening. If you could take your seats now and have a second go at hushing, that would be excellent. Well, good evening and welcome to you all, and welcome to this discussion and debate about reforming the United Nations and other international institutions. We have a most distinguished panel, real and virtual, I shall come back to that in a moment, to stimulate our conversation. Josip Čekovic, at the end, will briefly introduce the organisation behind this evening's event, Ubuntu and the World Campaign for the Reform of Global Governance Institutions. And our three main speakers will be then Boutros Boutros-Ghali, unfortunately on videotape, Mary Robinson and Federico Meyer. Boutros Boutros-Ghali has been held in France by the President of the Republic, who has urged him to stay on most important business. But I think it was probably the fact that he was coming to talk at an English university which would have caused dismay. But he's been held up here in France, and we're lucky to have him at all, albeit on a tape. I gather the tape is excellent, if a bit long, of some 20 minutes. The panel here today, and absent, but here nonetheless, is very distinguished. Boutros Boutros-Ghali, as you probably know, served as the sixth Secretary General of the United Nations from 1992 to 1996, with an extraordinary vision for UN and UN reform. He is now chairman of the South Centre, a group of 46 developing countries that champion South-South cooperation. Federico Meyer served as Director General of UNESCO from 1987 to 1999. I mean, that's almost a sinecure, isn't it? It's an extraordinary period of time in high public office. He now chairs the Madrid-based Foundation for the Culture of Peace, which he founded in 2000. And, of course, Mary Robinson is the former Irish President, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and is currently director of the Ethical Globalization Initiative. So let's begin by giving them a warm welcome. Before we start the main business, a few introductory remarks from me about the current context of global politics and discussion. Just a few remarks to set the scene, as it were, for this important and urgent set of reflections. From the United Nations system to the European Union, from changes to the laws of war to the entrenchment of human rights, from the emergence of international environmental regimes to the foundation of the ICC, in this trajectory of developments, I think there's a very optimistic and progressive and cosmopolitan story being told. A story which seeks to reframe human activity and embed it and entrench it in the rule of law, rights, and responsibilities. Now, it's important to remember that many of these post-1945 developments were framed against the background of formidable threats to humankind, above all Nazism, fascism, and the Holocaust. Those involved in pioneering these developments affirmed the importance of universal principles, human rights, and the rule of law in the face of strong temptations to simply put up the shutters and defend the position of only some countries, some nations, some people. But they rejected the view of national and moral particularists that belonging to a given community limits and determines the moral worth of individuals and the nature of their freedom. And they defended the irreducible moral status of each and every person. Cosmopolitan principles are enshrined then in these developments. The principles of equal respect, equal concern, and priority of vital needs of human beings are not principles for some remote utopia. They are already embedded in significant post-Second World War legal and political developments. But they are fragile. These fragile achievements are remarkable but vulnerable, and they now face the severest test. There are four interrelated reasons I want to give briefly for anxiety about our current abilities to address global problems, whether they're economic, political, security, or environmental problems. These concerns derive from four interrelated crises that now face the multilateral system. First, the Millennium Goals, the self-proclaimed moral standards of the international community, will not be met. They may be met in one or two regions of the world, but in general they will not. We are way off target. And yet these are the minimum standards that the international community has set down as the minimum permissible objectives for the international community's overall standards. Second, the trade talks promised at Doha broke down at Cancun, and these two first points interlock. The Doha round was to be a development round that addressed the double standards that prevail in the rules and regulations of the world trading system. The failure of talks at Cancun gives rise to grave anxieties about whether these issues can be addressed at all. There has been a substantial increase in the number of bilateral trade arrangements and preferential trading arrangements. Who will now address the pressing concerns of those who are least well off and who live in the poorest countries and are most marginal to the global economy is not clear. Third, little progress has been made towards addressing the hugely important issues of global warming. Some, but stacked up against the size of the task, little. But the polar caps are melting. A million species will die out within 40 to 50 years. The British chief scientist, Sir David King, has called global warming a bigger threat to humankind than global terrorism. He got into a lot of trouble for saying that, but he thought he'd said that on the basis of the evidence. And fourth, after the war in Iraq, multilateral institutions are weaker. The legitimacy of the UN Security Council is called into question, and all attempts to link a narrow security agenda to a broader human rights agenda are seriously damaged. And I'm an optimist. We're in danger of losing sight of some of the most important gains, of the post-Holocaust world, which ushered in and made progress towards a rule-based multilateral order. The challenge today is to blend economic interconnectedness, that's the economic world in which we live, with shared values, that's the human rights agenda, and a commitment to social justice, that's ameliorating the conditions, remedying the conditions of the least well off. Now, this agenda may be too great for us, but without meetings like this and discussions like this, we will not know. So it is to help us discuss this challenge that I've already introduced this distinguished panel, and we start with Josep to introduce the movement behind this evening's discussions, and then we will go on to the absent Boutros Ghali. We will sit down there whilst he's speaking up here, and then Mary Robinson will continue.
Thank you. Ladies, gentlemen, first of all, let me, as a coordinator of the ad hoc secretariat of the Ubuntu Forum and the World Campaign, to give our special thanks to the London School of Economics and concretely to Professor David Held and to the Center for the Study of the Global Governance for hosting and supporting this event. Thank you very much. And of course, we also would like to give our thanks to Mary Robinson to be here today as a speaker in this special event. And secondly, let me add my welcome to all of you and to also give our thanks for coming today. My job today in this presentation is reporting to you the main lines of the framework of the World Campaign for in-depth reform of the system of international institutions that was initially launched by the World Forum of Civil Society Networks, Ubuntu. At the end of 2000, Federico Mayor made a call to the different actors in civil society around the world. This call has led to the scheduling of two constitutive meetings in Barcelona in April 2001 and March 2002. At the first meeting, it was decided to create the World Forum of Civil Society Networks, called Ubuntu. Ubuntu is an age-old African term for humanness. As an ideal, it promotes cooperation between individuals, cultures, and nations. The Ubuntu Forum has the support from the main Catalan institutions and from some Catalania universities. The goal is to create a network of networks, a movement of movements in which unite yet diverse personalities and intellectuals, international organizations and institutions, people from the university and media, etc., can jointly draw structures and forums of opinion and encounters that make it possible to work for the values and principles that sustain life in a democracy, thereby attaining true human development on a worldwide scale. What are the vision and the mission of the Ubuntu Forum? In the foundation document, the blue document that you probably have now in your hands, we say the ultimate aim of the Ubuntu initiative is, given the particular seriousness of the current problems, to promote the construction of a world that is more human, just, peaceful, diverse, and sustainable, thus contributing to bring about a transition from a culture based on force and imposition towards a culture of peace, dialogue, justice, equity, and solidarity. And, as the document says, in order to achieve this, it will be necessary to be equipped with new procedures and institutions of democratic worldwide governance, taking always into account the active participation of civil society. And in accordance with this general vision and mission, in the second constituent meeting of the Ubuntu Forum, was decided to launch this world campaign for in-depth reform of the system of international institutions. After some first presentations, debates, and consultations, the first was in the context of the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg in 2002. The World Campaign has adopted the manifesto that you can read in the brochure of the campaign, the orange document that you also probably have in your hands. We declare in the manifesto the particular seriousness of the problems of challenge facing humanity, and in particular that. One, the globalization process is increasing the interdependence and complexity of world problems and widening the gap between rich and poor people. Whilst markets become increasingly global, the influence of political institutions required for their democratic, equitable, and effective functioning decreases every day. We witness the expansion of policies applied by world economic institutions which favor the market and the large corporations to the detriment of those promoting sustainable human development as set out in UN summits of the 19th and the millennium. Second, the weakening and the marginalization of the UN as regards peace and security issues has led to unilateral use of force in recent armed conflicts, such as Iraq. And then we propose in the manifesto this in-depth reform of the system of international institutions to guarantee the democratic governance of globalization to contribute to resolving the grave problems and challenges that face our world. And second, the establishment of mechanisms to enable the world's citizens and civil society organizations to achieve direct representation and participation in global decision-making processes within the framework of the international system. To pursuit of these goals requires a stronger, more democratic UN, placed at the center of a consistent, democratic, responsible, effective system of international institutions. More specifically, we need to democratize the composition and decision-making procedures of UN bodies and agencies to ensure that they are effective and democratic. And especially, we need to reform and integrate between the UN all other global multilateral organizations, IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, etc. These contents of the manifesto go hand in hand with some instrumental options and conceptions of the World Campaign itself. If we really want a process for in-depth reform of the system of international institutions to be launched, we need the mobilization of world citizens to promote and participate actively in the reform process. Therefore, we are searching for public opinion and civil society organization support for the campaign, expressed, for example, by signing the manifesto. We say, as a highlight of the campaign, make another world possible, reform international institutions, sign the manifesto, spread and join to the campaign. On the other hand, it is absolutely necessary to draw up agreements between civil society over the conceptual and methodological guidelines for such reform. And in accordance with this last point, today, in this significant event of the campaign, we would like to launch what we call, for obvious reasons, the London Declarations that you have also in your hands, probably. This declaration brings together a series of proposals developed over the last 2 years as part of the World Campaign for in-depth reform of the system of international institutions, public presentations of the campaign and consultations between world civil society as well as contacts with other movements working towards similar aims. This is not intended to be a closed proposal, but a starting point for debate and the dissemination of proposals to reform the system of international institutions, and which enjoys the initial support of several and significant participants of Ubuntu Forum and or initial supporters of the World Campaign. In the logical of the Ubuntu Forum and the World Campaign, each new document, after two interactions to improve it, has only the support of the legitimacy of the people and organizations that are explicitly signing it. Let me finish my participation in this event by reading and stressing some of the most significant proposals that are being declared today. About global democracy. The UN General Assembly should evolve, gradually unifying other General Assemblies and conferences, to play a central role in the system, with authority to adopt binding resolutions and to exercise effective control over the other bodies, agencies, and programs forming part of the system. All actors on the world scene should be empowered to effectively participate in the international institutions, and different forms of representation should be provided for each. Following the example of one of the oldest multilateral institutions, the International Labour Organization, specific assemblies could be established to guarantee participation by different government levels and actors from civil society in the broader sense of the term within the appropriate institutions. About peace and security. The present Security Council should be reformed and placed under effective UN General Assembly control, with a composition representative of all the world's regions. The right to use the veto must be restricted to certain issues, whilst steps are taken towards its eventual abolition, and votes over the most important issues should be according to a system of qualified majorities. Such reform should make it possible to effectively resolve conflicts, to develop effective conflict prevention mechanisms with the participation of regional organizations, and to establish an effective world peacekeeping force. All this should be accompanied by a global disarmament process. About sustainable human development and cultural diversity. A proposal currently enjoying broad support from different sectors is that of reforming the Economic and Social Council to transform it into an Economic, Social and Environmental Security Council with effective authority over UN agencies, funds and programs, the Bretton Woods institutions and the World Trade Organization. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank should return to their original mandates, establish democratic decision-making processes and become effectively integrated within the UN system. The World Trade Organization should be refunded within the UN and draft world trade policies suitable to support the fulfillment of global human rights and world social and environmental standards. At the same time, the UN should furthermore take urgent steps to establish a framework to regulate world financial flows. We specifically stress these proposals, and it's for these reasons that we talk about the reform of the system of international institutions more than the reform of UN itself. Such reform should make it possible to finally resolve the problem of fading debt, eradicate tax havens, establish world tax cooperation mechanism and global tax, and promote increase in official development aid provisions. All this should enable the operation of the international institutions to be co-financed and world cohesion funds for development to be established. Only in this way can we ensure that the Millennium Development Goals are met. All these reforms and policies must be accompanied by international strengthening of democratic rule and measures to prevent impunity at the international level in criminal, civil, economical, social, and environmental law. To this end, we should advance towards ensuring global rule of law. Two final points. First, the system of international institutions must also urgently begin taking measures to establish a framework guaranteeing plurality of information in the world. Second, finally, we should stress that only if gender equality and women's equal participation permeates all these proposals can be advanced towards another possible world. London, April the 1st. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, as the chair, I really feel alarmed by the time. I can't make Butcher's Gali shorter, so we welcome him now on tape for some 20 minutes. But we would all like then Mary to speak for at least 3 hours, but we'll have to be 15 minutes. All right, so we start with the tape now. Thank you.
I'm very sorry not to be among you to participate in this very important forum. Mia culpa, mia maxima culpa. I will talk about the reform of the United Nations and other international institutions. I believe that this reform is a must. It is a must for three political reasons and for four legal reasons. Let us begin with the three political reasons. One, the end of the Cold War and the necessity to manage the post-Cold War. Two, the globalization of the world. And three, the technical revolution in the field of communication, telecommunication, in different fields, in the field of armaments. So, these are the three political reasons. Now we have legal reason. The first one is that nation states are no longer the unique sources of sovereignty. Two, that state sovereignty exercised over a geographical territory are today under question. Three, states are no longer alone in the international scene. Other actors other non-state actors emerge, transnational corporations, non-governmental organizations, international terrorism, and finally, supranational legal rules have appeared, like humanitarian law, like protection of environments, like protection of human rights. So, for all those reasons, we need a drastic change in the United Nations system and in the different international agencies related to the United Nations. I will talk about the reform of three items. The first one, which is the democratization of the UN system. The second one is the reform of the Security Council and the peacekeeping and the reform of the peacekeeping operations, which are related to the work of the Security Council. And the third basic reform is related to the economic and social cooperation. Let us begin with the democratization. Before I left the United Nations, I published an agenda called Agenda for Democratization. It was the 16th of December 1996, and it was presented at the General Assembly, where I mentioned on this paper, this position paper, what are the reasons why we must do the democratization of the international community, the democratization of international relations, and that this democratization begin with the democratization of the United Nations system. So for me, the basic reform of the UN system is the participation of the non-state actors in international institutions, in international forums, by non-state actors, mentioning the NGO, the non-governmental organization, the regional organization, the multinational corporation, the municipality of big countries, the university, political parties, all of them represent the international civil society. And I will mention the three main non-state actors: the non-governmental organization, the regional organization, and the transnational corporation. The non-governmental organization, and today there are more than 20,000, the non-governmental organization can bring to the international community the democratic dimension which we are advocating. NGOs are proving extremely powerful in fighting isolationism, in fighting indifference among both governments and citizens. And how they will participate in the United Nations system is a technical problem. They can be represented according to their specialization: NGO dealing with human rights, NGO dealing with environment. They can be represented according to the region: NGO, African NGO, Latin American NGO, European NGO. This is a technical problem, but what is important is that they must participate in the work of the United Nations. Furthermore, during the last international conference from Rio de Janeiro in 1992 to the conference on human rights in Vienna in 1993, to the conference of social development in 1995, to the conference of women and development in Beijing, there were two conferences, the governmental one and the non-governmental one. So already the non-governmental organization are participating in the elaboration of the rule of tomorrow. Then among the non-state actors are the regional organization. And as you know, the Charter of the United Nations have mentioned in Article 52, 53, 54, the presence of regional organization, like the Arab League, the Organization of African Unity, the European Union, the Commonwealth, the Francophonie. We have many inter-regional organizations. And I, as Secretary General, have had two annual meetings of the representative of those regional organizations, and my predecessor continued this tradition, and once a year the United Nations have a meeting with the Secretary General, the director, the representative of the different regional organizations existing. And the cooperation with the regional organization are very important, because they represent a kind of decentralization. They can cooperate with the United Nations in the field of a peacekeeping operation. They have done it in Africa with the Organization of African Unity. They have done it in Yugoslavia with the NATO, with in Kosovo, where we have European, we have many regional organizations dealing with a peacekeeping operation. And finally, among the non-state actors, we have the transnational corporation. And those transnational corporations are more powerful than the majority of the member states of the United Nations. They are playing an extremely important role in economic development. This not only occurs through foreign investments, but also through the transfer of technology and skills. So they can play a very important role, and it is important to obtain their participation in the United Nations system. And finally, the participation of non-state actors to obtain the democratization of the United Nations system is not an innovation. The International Labour Organization brings together at its general conference delegates from governments, employers, and workers from each member state, all of whom are entitled to vote individually on all matters. So this, the ILO was created even before the League of Nations. It is the oldest international organization, and it is based on the participation of non-state actors, all representative of the civil society. Now let us talk about the second reform. The second essential reform is, and we have discussing since the last 20 years, the reform of the Security Council. And the present Security Council should be reformed, with a composition representing the different region of the world. Was done after World War II, it means in 1945. We are in 2004. The key. Change. We must admit that the Security Council don't community, and it needs a change. It needed change in the want to enter in the details, but there is a consensus that to represent the international community, to represent the family.
these things happen. I do apologize. I thought he was in great shape, and actually it was going extremely well. What he had to say had a lot of momentum. I would have, like all of you, would preferred that we finished it. So the downside is that we've lost Buchas Ghali for reasons I cannot comprehend. The tape was all right, but there must be a problem with the tape now or with the technology. But the upside is that instead of cutting you from 3 hours to 15 minutes, we can give you 20 minutes, which we'd all very much like. So welcome, Mary Robinson.
Well, good evening, and I'm very pleased to join with you in this world campaign for reform of the United Nations and the other international institutions. I listened with great interest, actually, to what we could hear of Dr. Buchas Ghali. He does set things out very clearly and methodically, and in a way we need that as a kind of background. I don't, in fact, intend to do that because I felt that my contribution this evening would be more coming to the issue from a strong human rights and gender perspective and talking about the moment that we find ourselves in, because we have to also ask ourselves, why now? Why is this the moment when we would particularly want to engage? And why is it that here in LSE you have come to discern just what is it that we need to be really reflecting on? Yes, Buchas Ghali set out the arguments that I think we are fairly familiar with. And I just want to explain perhaps also what brought me into addressing the values of globalization when I left the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the way in which that has enabled me to connect with this wider movement that Ubuntu in very large part gathers in. But it is a very wide social movement, and it is linking in a way that didn't happen before those whose concern is about the environment, environmental activists, those whose concern is development, development experts, and those who are from the human rights community, the women's movement, and other movements. We saw it, I'm glad to say, at the conference on sustainable development in Johannesburg, the kind of banner, no sustainable development without human rights. Dr. Buchas Ghali referred to two major world conferences that took place in the 90s, the Rio conference in 1992. If you look at the text of Rio, the Agenda 21 and so on, there's no reference to human rights. And the year later, he referred to the world conference in Vienna on human rights, and there was no mention of the environment. So at least we have learned. We've learned to try to link across, to try to connect value systems. And in trying to connect value systems, very importantly, trying to ensure that governments are held accountable. We had a rich setting in place in the last half of the 20th century of frameworks of values, and I particularly want to focus on the framework of international human rights norms and standards, and the six core instruments, and now we have the further convention for migrant workers and their families, but the six core instruments have been ratified by the vast majority of countries in the world, which we need to remember. So we have a framework which governments have committed to, but we know that neither are the commitments being implemented sufficiently in individual countries, nor have we found effective ways collectively to ensure enforcement of these instruments. And thinking about this at the end of my term as High Commissioner, I was aware that it would be important to see in what way the value system of human rights and indeed environmental standards, labour standards, control of small arms, etc., how these could be part of the rules of the road of a wider globalization. And I became conscious of a shift in the development of the strong critique of globalization and social movement worldwide. It had developed from an anger and frustration that was very evident in the streets, be it in Seattle, be it in Genoa, be it in various other places, to a much more focused discussion at all sorts of different levels of how can we put forward credible alternatives, as we've heard, to a more democratic and responsive UN, more responsive WTO, IMF, World Bank, but also the role of multinational corporations, the way in which civil society would seek to hold to accountability. And I saw this at a meeting that I attended in Porto Alegre, but I saw it, I think, even more evidently at the World Social Forum, which this year, as you know, was held in Mumbai in India. I participated in a panel with Federico at Mumbai and other seminars on accountability in the context of human rights violations, impunity, etc. And in a way, I see a sort of cycle in January of going from the World Social Forum in Mumbai, where a lot of the focus was on the need to reform the international financial institutions, to the up the mountain in Switzerland, where very powerful figures in the world of representative multinational corporations and governments gather annually, as we know, for the World Economic Forum. But there's also a public eye on the World Economic Forum. And this year, the focus of the public eye was on the accountability of multinational corporations, transnational corporations. And even in Davos itself, there is a global governance initiative which will publish its results shortly in Washington in mid-April. And that is an exercise which is interesting that the Davos Economic Forum initiated. And they have an ability to carry the message very effectively, as we know, in media terms. But the impact of that global governance initiative is to look at performance in implementing the Millennium Development Goals. As David Held said, these are not being implemented, and this was an exercise of looking at the responsibility of international institutions, of governments, of the private sector, and of civil society. And there were a number of task forces established, and I'm on a steering group that was bringing this together and deciding on the status, the degree of implementation. And it won't surprise you to know that under all four headings, the rate of implementation is poor. Somewhere between 3 and 4 out of 10 was a crude way of trying to measure. But what we were doing, and there's a lot of analysis and literature on this and academic study, is we were showing that the commitments of the Millennium Development Goals are not being implemented, that the commitments at the Monterey Conference on Financing for Development for an extra $50 billion a year in development assistance have not been implemented, that governments have not committed in a serious way or renewed their commitment to reaching the 0.7% of GDP of developed countries to ensure that there would be an adequate link of support in development assistance. So I come back to my question then, why now is it important that we have a movement for root and branch reform, for genuine taking the opportunity to say we can't go on as we are? I think we can see a number of different components of this. As I said, one of those components is a determination of a social movement, that there are credible alternatives and that we're going to work together and share experiences, share inputs, and it can be done. This is, I believe, because of a combination of frustration at the lack of progress and the shock to the world system of the attacks of 9/11, which resulted in a very strong focus on security, but less on the kind of human security which was analysed in the recent report on human security now, and more on security from the point of view of trying to have territorial security in homeland security in the United States and other measures that are taken, but also military means of trying to pursue human security. understandably, this is a priority, and indeed, from a human rights point of view, ensuring the security of citizens is an absolute priority. But I think there is another challenge, another vision of a broader approach to security, which we now have before us because of two recent reports. One, the responsibility to protect, setting out the criteria on which it is important to protect, reshaping the whole debate from when is it appropriate to have humanitarian intervention to a responsibility to protect, which begins with the responsibility of governments to protect their citizens, responsibility of the international community to uphold the standards for that protection. But if you have the government as part of the problem, if you have failed states setting out quite clearly criteria when it is appropriate for a wider intervention by various measures in order to ensure that the human rights are protected, that human security is protected. And then the second report under the co-chairmanship of Amartya Sen and Sadako Gata, looking at the broader aspects of human security. And these are the backdrop to the situation that we're in at the moment. Because I've been engaged with my colleagues in the Ethical Globalization Initiative in taking the system of human rights out of its traditional world and box where human rights people understand and know the importance and believe in the system, into bringing that human rights framework into issues of trade and development, into a right to health in tackling the various world health issues, whether it's neglect of diseases, the pandemic of HIV and AIDS, the neglect of women in the context of their health, reproductive rights, and so on. And the third area, bringing a human rights lens and perspective into issues of migration, being aware of the importance of having a paradigm change in the way that we look at migration so that it becomes a positive issue to be managed and where we have a focus on those who are vulnerable. When we look in a human rights lens at the world, I think it brings home the stark divides, indeed the different worlds that we have, even though we have, as David Helder said, greater connectedness. In fact, that connectedness is also a way of identifying the extent of the divides. They were, I think, well captured in the UN Human Development Report for 2003. We saw in that Human Development Report, which was focused on the eighth Millennium Development Goal, the need for a compact, the need for a real engagement between the rich countries and those countries that are in a cycle of poverty for a variety of reasons that are well identified in that report. And it showed that during the 90s, 54 countries got poorer, that life expectancy fell in some 34 countries, that child mortality rose, that child attendance at school shrank in a number of countries, that some countries like Zambia, for example, can't train teachers fast enough to replace those teachers who have died or become too ill to teach because of HIV and AIDS. And it's those stark realities. I've become aware from talking to audiences that sometimes when you mention figures, and we're all familiar with the figures of those who live in absolute poverty, I think it's always important to add that the significant majority of those who live in absolute poverty are, of course, women, and there is a feminization of poverty problem there. But we're kind of distanced from the impact of those figures until we break them down a little bit and look both at the scale of them and what that means and how we can have a world where that happens. And I just use two sets of figures that relate to children to illustrate, because I recall being here in this theatre, in fact, for a launch of a global report on child poverty that Peter Townsend and a number of other academic colleagues had compiled. And they had used human rights criteria to identify the extent of child poverty. They had the survey encompassed more than 1.2 million children in more than 40 countries. It was one of the largest, I think, the largest survey ever, where it looked at the basic needs, or as we in the human rights community call them, basic rights to food, to safe water, to shelter, to sanitation, etc. And these were the way in which they measured the impact. And the result is a profile of our world, a startling bringing home of just how different life is from the life chances of a child born. UNICEF come up with a figure of some 6.3 million children who die of hunger each year. That's actually larger than the population of my native country, Ireland. And it always evokes in me the memories that I have, and I'm sure some of you also have had that experience, of seeing children die in the arms of their parents, whether it's at a feeding station, in a refugee camp, in a poor clinic without proper sanitation, where there is a death from unnecessary polluted water and lack of proper sanitation. In each case, it's a personal tragedy, it's a family tragedy, that we could have a world where we don't stop to have a moment of collective shame is you know, something that beggars, I think, a further sense of how one of our greatest enemies is, in fact, indifference. It is an unwillingness to engage. So in the light of the inadequacies of the international institutions and the suffering that occurs in millions of households on a daily basis, those for whom human security doesn't mean a possible fear of a chemical, biological, terrorist threat. It means, where will the next meal come from? How can I get medicines to save a dying child? When can I ever hope for a decent job? How will I ever be able to have any possibility of a decent life unless I get into the hands of criminal gangs who will traffic for money across borders, or traffic indeed for other purposes? So what I would like to just discuss with you imaginatively for a few minutes, because here we are gathered in the old theatre in LSE. Many of us are almost too familiar with the problem to be able to shape it again in a compelling way, and yet there is a sense of a moment, and it's like the moment when huge change was brought about by a few individuals. We'd had the horrors of two world wars, the Holocaust, etc., and a small number of legal scholars under the chairmanship of Eleanor Roosevelt had the imagination and courage and presence to continue a dialogue under the auspices of the Commission of Human Rights and draft a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was drafted very carefully to be accessible. You recall that Eleanor Roosevelt lectured the legal scholars that she was chairing, reminded them that she wasn't a scholar, and said, don't write it in lawyers' language or UN speak. If I can't understand it, how will it be understood in small places close to home? And I don't think that she or her colleagues could have possibly imagined how important for our world that document was and is. It was in the preamble to the Millennium Declaration. It was reiterated, if you like, recommitted to by the largest gathering ever of representatives of governments. And yet it is made a mockery of by the reality. How can we say, as Article 1 does, that we are all free and equal in dignity and rights? And indeed, interestingly, dignity before rights. How can you have dignity when you live in stark, horrible, absolute poverty and bury your children early and have a constant worry about where the next meal will come from? And that is the reason why, combined with a certain shock to the system, as I said, of a focus on human security, that I believe there is a new moment. I believe that there are so many critics of globalization as we currently perceive it, the Washington Consensus, the fact that the divides are stark and wide, and it's into the poor, divided part of that world that another 2 billion people will be born a very short period of time. And so the figures will worsen, the divides will worsen, and I'm not even bringing into the picture the economic, the environmental issues. Save to say that 2 days ago, I participated, 3 days ago and 2 days ago, I participated in a meeting in Columbia University called the State of the Planet meeting, with about 1,200 participants, many of them leading scientists from around the world. And nothing that I've heard from this platform was as alarming as the message that those scientists were conveying. We have huge threats to our planet, which is another reason. The problem of global warming is an extraordinarily serious one, and there are many other threats to biodiversity, etc. So this is a time like the end of the Second World War, when there is a huge need to take stock and also to recognize that we have assets at our disposal, as well as reform of the international institutions, which is the main focus of our campaign in this context. I would also plead for a part of the social movement to focus on a rigorous holding to accountability, holding to accountability of international organizations, which should be at the forefront of upholding the standards of human rights that have been entered into. That's in the international covenants and conventions. It's not just an individual exercise, it's also a collective responsibility. Holding of governments to accountability, holding the private sector, business, to accountability. We actually have an interesting business debate going on at the moment that many of you will know about, work that was completed by the UN Subcommission on Human Rights last August, the norms and responsibilities of transnational corporations and other business. That is a frame which makes it very clear that the international human rights norms and standards are the primary responsibility of governments, and indeed of the international organizations in support of governments, but that because of the power having shifted, because of services having shifted, services in provision of education, health, prison systems, security, and so on, that there is also necessarily a huge responsibility of international, multinational corporations and other business. So there is a need, as part of a component of a more values-led globalization, working for a fairer globalization, that we hold those who exercise power, those who affect people's lives directly, hold them to the human rights and other standards that are part of the legal infrastructure which has been built up and which can, I believe, make a huge impact here. And I think that the interesting thing is to see that this message is getting out. I really sort of end on this point because it's one of seeking to link the work that has been done in the establishment of those norms, the work of the committees that monitor in Geneva, and also at regional level, for example, in the European Union context, but also and the work of the UN special rapporteurs and representatives of the Secretary General. All of that work is becoming more of a framework providing processing tools for civil society. And it's encouraging to see the increasing expertise. It's encouraging to see that there's now, for example, an NGO called Dignity International, which is seeking to do for economic, social, and cultural rights what Amnesty International worked so strongly for in political prisoners, combating torture, more on the civil and political rights. Amnesty and bodies like Human Rights Watch are also aware of the importance of working at grassroots level and supporting groups on holding to accountability for economic, social, and cultural rights. So as well as looking for accountability and democratization of the UN institutions and the other major financial institutions, we need to link in a coherent experience-sharing global movement in holding governments accountable for commitments already made and taking the reality of those commitments into areas of trade and development, into migration, into tackling, as a matter of health, the pandemic of HIV and AIDS. The fact that in sub-Saharan Africa, where you have in excess of 29 million people who are HIV positive or have full-blown AIDS, a tiny fraction, less than 100,000, have access to antiretroviral drugs and treatment. So we're not just talking about a right to health, actually. We're talking about a right to the normal prolonging of life in the developed world. And we're talking about the impact on young parents, on teachers, nurses. And these are developmental issues. They are huge concerns. They are also huge travesties of human rights, a huge kind of immunity from responsibility, unless we pin to responsibility. So my appeal, as I join wholeheartedly in this campaign, is let's come at it from different directions. Let's look at reform of the UN international organizations, but let's also use the tools we have, and let's make them more implemented because we hold to accountability, and because we share expertise in this, because we know how to access the good practices of what works, and because we are insistent that the world has to be changed. It can't go on as it is. Thank you very much.
Very good. Very good. Very good.
I'm very keen that we have enough time for questions. So, Federico, you could perhaps just take the most 15 minutes now. I've been given a note that says that another copy of the video has been found, and we could at the end of these speeches run it. But my inclination is to try and put it on the LSE website, otherwise the evening will go on for too long. Is that the, I think that is definitely the sense of the meeting. So we will do our best to put Boutros-Boutros Ghali on the website so you can look at it from tomorrow onwards. Federico.
Thank you so much. At the end of a terrible war in 1945, there was a moment of, you can imagine, the Holocaust, the genocide, the most abominable systems of extermination, and they thought that there were solutions if they were all together, all, and if they were united. And it is for this that the United Nations were created. And it is for this that they did not start the charter saying, we the winners, or we the states, or we the governments. They said, we the peoples. We, all the peoples, all the countries. Because they were aware that there is no country or peoples or cultures so small that has not a lesson to give, and there is not a country so huge that has not a lesson to learn. And they went to San Francisco under the leadership of the United States, and as you know, they founded the United Nations. And was here in London during the war in 1942, that the minister Butler thought that only if we are educated, this means not if we are informed, no, if we are educated, this means if we have our own answers, if we are able to think our own opinion and positions in the different issues. At this moment, if we have this vision of the world, if we are citizens of the world, at this moment, we can find the solution. And was nearly at the same time, only some months later, after San Francisco, was here in London, that the intellectual arm of the United Nations was founded in the School of Engineers. And it was said, utilizing a phrase of a poet, of Archibald MacLeish, a writer of the United States, it was said, since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be built.
This means that through education, science, and culture, we must build peace every day with our behavior. It's not the thing that is given to us. It's the same thing with freedom or with justice or with love. We must rebuild every day. We cannot wait. And now we will receive peace. And now we will receive freedom. This was this active way of conceiving this new step after the terrible Second World War. And as I was telling you, was here in London, and the first Director General was Julian Huxley, brother of Aldous Huxley and half-brother of Andreas Huxley. There was a Nobel laureate on molecular biology, biochemistry. Well, what I would like to tell you is that there was a vision that is the human beings, all the human beings, all together, that can, when they act in this way, they can find solutions for global problems, because they are all and are united. And today, precisely, and I must thank immediately Professor David Hill, but his global governance visions, precisely we have the opposite. We have today the immense contradiction of democracy, demos, people, and krasi, this means that are the rulers, through the vision of each individual person, unique human being, and the global governance needs to have also a democracy at the worldwide level. And the contradiction is that we have democracies, sometimes to be improved, by the way, but at the supranational level, we have a jungle. We have no rules. The rules that we have sometimes are not followed, are not observed, and there is a complete impunity, and we have all these traffics, and we have the possibility of having even traffics of persons. I must warn about this. This is becoming really a shame for the humanity as a whole, that not only drugs, arms, capitals, ideas, patents, not only these. Today we have traffic of peoples, of persons. And all this in impunity. Why? Because we have not a democratic frame. We have not a system, the United Nations system, that is able to provide this frame in which all these rules, rules related, as Mary Robinson was saying, not only on security, not only on economy, not only in better sharing, also in environment, on culture, in order to avoid losing this diversity that is our richness, and not losing these values that are our force. If we are united by some universal values, and the Declaration of Human Rights is, in this respect, extremely important. Before long, unfortunately, as you know, before long, the peoples was changed by we, the powerful. And before long, too, the aid, the support, the grants were changed by loans. And loans that were given in draconian conditions. They were given in order that very often they were more beneficial for those that were given the loans than those for those that were receiving the loans. I think that in this very well-known center throughout the world, I am sure that you will study the structural adjustment conditions, and you will realize that this was not the best way of sharing. That was the real idea that was surrounding all the United Nations system, was how to better share. How to better share. Well, as it has been already said, we have today a constellation of institutions at the worldwide level, and what we must try to do is to improve them in order that these rules are followed, that are observed. As we were in a democracy at the world level, at the world scale, in which we have rules, we have laws, that if there are transgressors of the laws, then we can have one institution that can oblige the compliance with the rules. And this is, in my view, the very important issue that we are facing. We have today a lot of studies on who, with the peoples, on with whom. We have organizations that must be improved, but we have organizations on health, on economy, on labor, on education, on environment, on development. We have a lot of organizations. The World Trade Organization, we have also economic and financial institutions. We have all these. And on these we have a lot of work and diagnosis. We have contributed also to this global democratic governance and the reform of the international institutions, the role of Europe in the reform of United Nations, global democratic governance, etc., etc. But, as it has been said, I am a molecular biologist, and I know very well that the diagnosis, what really matters with the diagnosis is to inspire a treatment. And the treatment must be timely. Because otherwise, if we have a right diagnosis and we have the treatment, but we are unable to apply this treatment timely, then it's too late. And I must tell you that we are in a moment in which we are repeating more and more, and now another diagnosis, another report. A reporting society is a postponing society. We must try to have this cohesion that Mary Robinson supports, and of course I am in her side. We must try to take advantage of all the things that we have already. We must try to come back in many occasions to their original missions. And we must say, now we must apply. When we have already a solution, we must apply this treatment. I remember very often, I was during many years in my life in works related with to prevent mentally retarded children, perinatal biochemistry, and I remember that very often I was said, if you like, we can make another analysis. No, because in this way the diagnosis will improve. The better diagnosis, the perfect one, is autopsy. But it's too late. Therefore, we must have this in mind. We have today already, we have the who, with whom. Now we need to very well establish the how. How can we today have the mechanisms that when we have already good rules, good conventions, good declarations, good resolutions, good commitments, as was the case in the summit for social development in 1995 in Copenhagen, were not resolutions or declarations anymore, were commitments. How we can be involved in these commitments? Therefore, this how today, in my view, is the most important answer that we must give. We must comply with these rules, because today we are able, for example, you were talking about global warming. Today we are able to identify through the Global Ocean Observatory System. We know what are the oil tanks that are washing their tanks in the ocean. And they are spoiling the ocean, that is the lungs of our children. How we can tolerate that the future of humanity is being put under a question mark? Therefore, we must have the mechanisms. We must try that now the next movement is with all the NGOs, representatives of civil society, the parliaments. Here among us we have parliamentarians, we have the media. We must be all together, as at the beginning, all the peoples, all united by some universal values. And we must all request this accountability of the government in order to come back to with the peoples and not with the powerfuls, or we, the powerful, because today we have near the transition from a multilateral system to a hegemonic system. And this is extremely dangerous for our future. And I would like to conclude telling you that I think that one of the most impressive aspects of the lucidity, of the farsightedness of the foundation of the United Nations was when they said, we the peoples, we have decided to save the succeeding generations, to look from the present to the future. Because the past, we can describe the past, but the past is already past. We can learn the lessons from the past, but we cannot rewrite the past because it has already been written. Then, what is the only thing that we can offer to young people, to newborn, to those that are unborn now? What we can offer to them? We can offer a clear page to be written by themselves. And it is for this that we cannot tolerate, even if it is the highest power in the world that decides this. We cannot tolerate that these pages that must be written by the young people, the new coming generations, are written today by any kind of power in the world. Concerning culture, concerning environment, concerning ethics, concerning security, nobody must write today what belongs to the young people and to the succeeding generations, as it is said so beautifully in the Charter of the United Nations. We must mobilize. Mary Robinson was talking about a determination of a social movement. I think that we must now try, all of us, to help in this determination through the parliaments, through the councils, the town hall councils, through the media, through the associations, through the NGOs, through the internet. Let us make this determination of social movements in such a way that we can, as we did the 15th of February of the year 2003, as we have done now, most unfortunately, after this terrible terrorist attack in Madrid. All the young people were there. Why? Because they were moved. What I wish is that we are aware that are everyday moving situations. Mary Robinson was saying some of these situations. We must think every day in those that are living in inhuman conditions, that are dying of hunger. And perhaps in this way we will be able to mobilize all the world in order to come back to the origin and to be all of us, all the peoples, and to be united. Thank you.
I know some of you will need to go now and go on to other meetings or families. If you wish to leave, do so now so we can have questions without people coming and going.
Can I borrow some of your water?
Of course. Yes, yes. Because you arrived this morning and a long way, yes.
No, I know from your experience that if you don't give them this opportunity, it'll just go on. So if you could, if those who are going could do so very quietly, we don't need to hear you. I'll start taking questions. They should be very brief questions. We won't take statements. If you make statements, I'll simply interrupt you. So they should be questions that can generally be answered by yes or no, but we'll allow a few longer words. I'll take clusters of questions, so the panel will just have the opportunity at the end to engage in some of the issues. So we won't have a question answer. Let's have as many questions on the table as possible over 10, 12 minutes. And Professor Halliday.
Thank you. Thank you for a very fascinating talk. I agree with you about the mainstreaming of human rights with other issues, and I agree with you about the urgency of the crisis. But I have to say, having listened to discussions of reform of institutions these past 10 or 15 years, much of what you said, if I may say so, is dreaming, and speaking of the young, irresponsible in its dreaming, because these proposals have been discussed and they are not as simple as you present them, and I'll give you three quick examples.
Quick.
Regional organizations, the bully on the block. The Russians in the Caucasus, the Nigerians in West Africa, the US in the Caribbean, is this what you want? NGOs, how do you distinguish between the NGOs which are liberal and nice and the ones run by the mafia, the secret police, the right-wing anti-feminists, and all the rest? And thirdly, don't please compare this to 1945, because in 1945 the US was in favor, and now you have avoided it, but the US is absolutely against, and it makes reform extremely difficult. So I've been a bit precise, but I'd like your answer.
Thank you. Very much. A model of clarity.
Thank you. Very stimulating presentations. Mary Robinson emphasized what she called the rigorous holding to account of both governments and businesses. And Frederica Mayer talked about the importance of how one might do this and the need for sort of established mechanisms. Now, I don't hear too much about that kind of thing. For example, Kofi Annan's Global Compact, which signed up, I don't know how many hundred multinationals, there is, to my knowledge, no wish, much less any system for monitoring their behavior and how they relate to the seven principles that they're supposed to have signed up to. The Center for Transnational corporations that existed in the UN up to the time of Rio, when it was very active in proposing monitoring of all those great things at Rio, was disbanded shortly afterwards by pressure from you-know-who. The Rwanda genocide that many of us will be remembering next week, to what extent should those responsible for decisions in the Security Council that led to that be accountable, and what is the mechanism for that? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. James Putzel from the Crisis States Research Center here at the school. I'm inspired by the idealism of all the speakers, but I wanted to just raise three questions related to those points. First, a General Assembly is only as good as its members. So I'd like to know what the global civil society movement is doing to reinforce the public authorities in individual states that could strengthen the General Assembly. Secondly, the Security Council is a matter of pragmatic real politics. It's a collection of big powers and some small powers, perhaps, that shouldn't be there. Wouldn't it be more effective to think about redressing the balance in the Security Council at the moment by adding India, perhaps Brazil, maybe the European Union, and getting rid of small island states that have that kind of clout? And thirdly, isn't the biggest challenge to the United Nations for the future being able to welcome and protect that growing notion of definition of sovereignty as being linked to responsibility to the defense of citizens, being able to enforce that and develop a respect for that without double standards? So in other words, the same standards we hold an Iraqi state to, we have to hold an Israeli state to. And that right now, the biggest threat to multilateral governance is a bellicose United States that's arrogant and wielding military power on its own, unfortunately supported by some lesser European states. Thanks.
There's a dangerous tendency to use the opportunity to raise one issue to smuggle in several. So let's try, in the interest of spreading this discussion, to keep it down, please. Yeah.
Well, this is quite short. My question goes to ask you your personal opinions that how commit do you think the countries that have the power, with a veto power in the Security Council, will be willing to give up that power in order to protect humanity? Do you think they are going to really commit with the rest of the world, or this is going to just be something that we're going on.
Thank you. Thank you. Mike over here.
Yes. Chiara from IPB Italia, Italian office. I was thinking about two aspects. One is the gender perspective in this, a more egalitarian gender perspective inside the United Nations. How can this gender perspective be implemented so that we can shift from the famous poet's words, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men and women that peace can be built. Okay? And also a problem concerning what human rights are. Human rights that have been devised and described about 50 years ago, let's say, the same for the whole world.
Thank you. Wait. Next, other way, other way.
Hi. My question's regarding things are quite it's quite a different world since 1945, and that the Asia Pacific region is becoming a lot more important and in this century. And I was just wondering if the panelists could make a comment on perhaps China and its role, and combined with shared value systems, and I guess in the reform process of all international organisations in the coming in the century.
Thank you. Can you speak up? Yeah.
All right, I do agree with you people that obviously the environment's very important, but I think if you're going to, how are the developing countries going to grow, and you need the growth to eradicate poverty, education, if you're not going to let them exploit the environment, which unfortunately they'll have to do obviously if they want to grow.
Gentleman down here.
Josep of Ubuntu had a very long wish list. Could he invite him and the panel to expand on how this could be achieved? For instance, the future role of the Economic and Social Council, the reform of the Security Council, and how the corporate bodies, transnational corporations, abrogation of human rights can be dealt with. So can we have the actual details of how could it be done?
Up here, please.
Yes, my question is extremely simple. How, as Mrs. Nobody, can I actually do anything to help this change? I mean, you as important people within the UN structure do have a certain power. But apart from signing a petition, which I do not feel has a real power, I don't understand exactly how I could do anything about the issue that you are addressing today.
And
Good evening. Thank you very much again for coming tonight. I have two quick points. Mr. Mayer said that a reporting society is a postponing society, but one of the things that came to my mind is that maybe creating as it was put earlier on, networking the network would be in a way playing the game of reporting again and again, and maybe this over-centralization of the international institutions would be not pointless, but would not necessarily be the best way to deal with the situation and moving on that much. When local initiatives, for example, have proved so efficient over the past years, such as microbanking, for example. And another very quick point, it's an open question about what you think should be the role of the groups of regionally integrated countries in this reform. Thank you very much.
I think it's good to have a roll of issues on the table because it gives you a chance to speak. I mean, obviously our panel will not be able to address all these issues, but I think one of the reasons we're here is as much to listen to to what has to come up from the audience as to simply respond. So let's just keep going for a bit longer.
A question about the crisis in confidence in the Security Council, which Kofi Annan referred to last September as the states of the world and the people of the world needed to regain confidence in the Security Council. Seems to me there's some glaring reasons for that lack of confidence, and I wonder what the panel thinks should be done about certain issues. And if I could just give two examples. One is the Security Council itself was responsible for sanctions against Iraq, which caused the deaths of over a million people, sometimes described as genocide. Ought it not to establish a tribunal to investigate those people responsible for this genocide rather than just let it slip away into history as if nothing's happened? And also, only last year, there was a completely illegal war against Iraq, and nothing seems to be being done about a tribunal to try those people responsible for the deaths of 10,000 plus people in Iraq.
Thank you very much. Very briefly now, I'm going to give everyone who still wants to say something about 30 seconds. So try and stick to 30 seconds, which will be hard for you, I know.
My question's for whoever wants to answer it. I'm just curious to hear some of your predictions about the proposal for Cypriot unity that was announced yesterday and went to a referendum today.
On trust. I know this gentleman.
Professor Real, it's 1st of April, but we are optimistic that there will be a reform. The question is to the panelists, maybe to Mary, Commissioner Mary Robertson or Frederica Mayer. See, what do you need? Whether more resources from the GI countries are shoulder to shoulder, madam, or less interference from these people? We all think that it is both. So what is that could bring us this reform? So that we have been talking forever. Maybe next April, David, regards. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You did brilliantly well. You reward people who can stick to it, and I know that was really hard for him.
It seems that the panel is talking about forging a political movement out of civil society organisations, but there are 20,000 of them or more. I was recently at the Human Commission at the Global Commission on the Commission on Human Rights in Geneva. You had about 40 NGOs from Colombia, all working in different directions. How do you forge a united political movement out of these disparate organizations?
Okay, we're going to be even more brief because we've got to, for reasons of staffing, we have to bring this to an end quite soon. So,
how do you get anywhere when the largest player doesn't want to participate?
Exactly. Can I just elaborate on that question and just sneak in one? Fred Halliday mentioned this right from the beginning, you did as well, in this question. It seems to me one of the most pressing issues on any global agenda is really, frankly, how to re-engage the U.S. And that's not just to re-engage the U.S. government, it's to re-engage the U.S. population, middle America, and so on, that doesn't have an imagination for the ramifications of global economic power. And it's why I think the engagement of middle America actually is a serious educational project.
Just following on from what you're saying, what can we give the people of the United States in return for their doing that?
Yeah, I think there the issue has to be the balancing of security issues with human security issues, because only if we as a movement recognize legitimate security issues can there be a basis, it seems to me, of future discussion. But I'm not answering the question.
My question is whether the international law should be changed to allow more scope for humanitarian intervention in different states.
Right. Last, I'm afraid, because of the hour.
Thanks. There are two strands of thought in the propositions for reform. On the one hand, as epitomized by Federico Mayor's remarks, there needs to be unity. That sometimes means the lowest common denominator that can equate for inaction, as was the case for preventing the war on Iraq. On the other hand, division is a principle on which many NGOs have been founded upon. For instance, Médecins Sans Frontières, which neglects the warnings by governments of failed states and acts based on need. It seems that before the agenda can be set, a mechanism needs to be formed to reconcile these different strands. Any thoughts, any plans?
Right. Now, is anybody so desperate about raising a question. You'll have to really justify this with the profound nature of your question. So I'll take two really desperate people. Okay, over there at the back.
Well, it's a different kind of question. It's just to think, there's only so many resources, there's only so much money, there's only so many good minds, and it seems that a lot of the discussion is very forward-looking, which is great, but I'm caught in a conundrum. I wonder if any of the panel have any children, and we're thinking about the future of the next generation, but we don't have enough resources to invest in what's going on now and think about the future, and I just wonder if they can comment how to deal with that.
Thank you. Penultimate question from a second desk.
Yeah, you just go from conference to conference and you talk and talk. When I was at the Michelangelo Hotel in Johannesburg at the big meeting in Johannesburg, I just wanted to know from the panel, how does 80 pound a head crayfish taste when you 8 miles from Soweto?
Finally.
Heard a lot about better representation of non-state actors such as NGOs, such as transnational corporations, etc. Not much about better representation of global, the you and I, the global citizen, direct representation.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll have to draw it to an end there. I'd like to ask, perhaps we just come along from this direction, but I really must keep you to 2 minutes each, so be selective, focused, and sharp. And pick up one or two of the pleasant as well as less pleasant challenges. And I'll say something about children and resources at the end.
Well, it's impossible for me to give answers to your questions. I think that there are one aspect that is very common in your questions, that is the two sides of the question, in the sense of some kind of a skeptical position about the dreamers and so on. I need to do a general reflection because there are a lot of... I think that the world in this moment is getting worse, and this is a very true statement. So, of course, we can adopt a skeptic position saying, well, nothing is possible to do, and things are happening, and anyway. So this is, of course, not the position, I think, of the speakers of this afternoon as you listen. Things are getting worse, but it's in our hands, in the hands of all of us, to do the things in order to change this reality. So we are not in any fatal situation. This is not true. We are in a real situation in which the powers in the world are putting the direction of the things in a bad position. But if all of us, and many people in the world, social movements, NGOs, parliamentarians, local authorities, and so on, take their responsibility in this moment, in the same way that the population of the world are doing the big demonstrations that we have ever seen in the world in the last year against the war in Iraq, we have the possibility to put on the streets of the cities of the world our proposals for a different future. And I really believe in this. The question is not how to build a movement, a leadership of the movement that allows this. The question is how all of us in our universities, in our movements, in our organizations, we really invest our energy in the directions that we believe that are necessary. And now we think we have a lot of place in which we can do this, and we should do this.
Of course, I also will have some choice. The first one, the first question is, in my view, extremely important, how we can really take advantage of those organizations that are really were, that are efficient, and to put aside those that are not. I think that through the different question, it has been already the answer. And particularly, David Hill, you have given an answer. Because I was saying that that was a leadership in 1945, and now we need again the leadership. And of course, without the re-engagement of the United States, will be very difficult. But Europe has a role that is very important, and there are very big countries, very important countries today, as India, as Brazil, etc., that can help in this process. Therefore, I think that a leadership is needed, because what we cannot do is, like it's happening right now, the bad examples, they, I was said, how do you can distinguish the bad organizations and the good NGOs? Today, the bad examples are given precisely by the United States. Guantanamo, for example. How can we accept that this is still, today, the way in which the main power of the world is giving what we thought will be a lesson of justice and the way in which these matters can be dealt with? Therefore, yes, we must try to re-engage the United States, and we must try also that the European Union can be particularly important in this moment of giving. Another question was, what kind of authority in order, what mechanisms in order? This is a matter of authority, it's a matter of democracy. In a democracy, this authority comes from the people, because this people has the legality and the legitimacy of exercing this capacity of prosecuting those that are transgressors and applying justice to them. Therefore, we need the same at the international level. But if we have not, then we will have impunity as we have now. And therefore, I think that to provide with this moral authority and this with legal authority to the United Nations is essential. Otherwise, even as I was telling you, we have the possibility of identifying the oil tanks that are doing bad. But if we cannot apply afterwards the punishment that they deserve, we are completely useless. There has been a question very direct to the director, former Director General of UNESCO. Why you did not change in the minds of men and you did not add women? I must tell you that I have corrected in UNESCO through a committee all the issues related with chairmen. We have chairperson. We have the manpower. We have changed all these things. Well, there were some limits. For example, it was suggested the emancipation to be the FMPization. I thought that was that was too complicated. But why I said no to add women to the origin of wars? Because I think that until now, in an androgenic society, we are responsible, not the women. And I think that today, in which the women has only 10%, the voice of the earth is only 10% that of women. And the decision-making is only 4% at the world scale. How we can add that the women are also at the origin of the wars? I prefer, for the time being, to respect the original poem of Archibald Bagley. And it's for this, and the decision of Clement Attlee, by the way. And I prefer, for the time being, I would very much like that before long it is said that it's because in the minds of men and women that the solutions now are given, that we can redress the present situation. And finally, I would like to end with one thing that I consider is particularly important. Many of you have asked, well, this is too complicated, how we can deal with all these things. These are really a mess and is very difficult to, we have so many organizations, we have states, we have nations, we have international corporations. How we can manage? I think that we have the experience of people that is immensely important. As a former rector of one university, I know until what point one institution like this one is important in order to be a watchtower, not only to adjust to the events, but to be able to foresee and therefore to prevent. We can prevent, we can anticipate. But you know what happens? Let me very, very, a dear respect, very sincere. What happens is that we have been too silent too often. The academic institutions, the scientific institutions, we have been too silent too often. I knew quite well the Soviet Union. And I was always saying, well, they are silent because they can speak. But now we can speak. And I also remember that one day when I was a young professor, I was going to Oxford to work, and there was, in the emblem of Oxford was, Sapere Aude, dare to know. After some time in Oxford, I thought that it was more important the opposite. Know how to dare. We do not dare enough. And it is for this that are many problems that are not solved, because we are silent when we should be very outspoken.
I'm just going to pick a couple of questions from a very rich well of wide-ranging questions. First of all, the rigorous holding to account. I believe that this is incredibly important and that good work is being done, but we need more. And also, and this is part of a reform of the UN, if you like, it needs to be taken more seriously at the UN level itself. It was always something that I found, first of all, very surprising when I started my work as High Commissioner, because I hadn't been aware of this before, that all of the UN structures that support human rights, from the Office of High Commissioner to the committees to the rapporteurs, and the whole thing costs is provided with less than 2% of the budget of the UN. And then when you hear all these ministers coming in with their rhetoric how important human rights are, but in fact they get less than 2%, and that's a very deliberate decision. Because I've tried very, very hard, and my successor, Sergio de Mello, also tried, and I think the new High Commissioner, Louise Arbour, is very aware of the need for more resourcing. But governments don't actually want more effective scrutiny, neither developed nor developing countries. The United Kingdom does not like to be scrutinised for whether it is fully implementing its commitments under the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, for example, and resents this kind of scrutiny. So we do need to put some pressure for greater funding there, but also the tools are there now that civil society can use, and they are using more and more. That's one of the more optimistic points I was making. And they're linking. There's a networking website some of you might like to look at, ESCRNet, where you get something like 4,000 activists around the world sharing information in 5 languages now. On the way in which they're scrutinising what the World Bank is doing, what the IMF is doing, sharing information on court cases, on issues that are justiciable, like the treatment action case in South Africa and many other cases. So that is happening. There's also, still talking about accountability, the question of the accountability of corporations, given the huge power they exercise in our world. Reference is made to the problem that the Global Compact has gathered in a lot of companies but hasn't really required of them any serious commitment for that. I think that that is a problem, and that's why there is an increasing recognition of the importance of these norms and responsibilities of transnational corporations. But it's also important to work with the corporations who are prepared to identify what is the proper responsibility of corporations and not take away from the primary and still the predominant responsibility of governments. And I'm currently leading a business leaders initiative of human rights, at least I chair it, which involves now 8 major corporations prepared to test these boundaries and to in fact go more deeply into their commitments in corporate social responsibility, but specifically in the area of human rights. I think it is important to raise the challenge of the question of sovereignty itself. As Federico keeps repeating, the 3 initial words of the UN Charter are "we the peoples," and after that, as framed it very much safeguarded, understandably at that time, in 1945, the importance of the sovereignty of states. There has, in fact, been quite a shift. The whole focus of the international human rights norms and standards is that human rights concerns don't stop at borders. And we link that then with the important report on responsibility to protect and the high-level panel which the Secretary-General has set up. The question of Rwanda, the 10 years after the genocide, was raised. I was very concerned as High Commissioner that we don't have an effective way through the UN system of tackling gross violations of human rights. We must do that, or we will have more wars in Iraq. The UN must find a capacity from within to be prepared to address serious, egregious violations of human rights. Good question from up there. What can I do? I think that that's a question that a lot of people are asking seriously and want serious answers to. You know, what in fact can I really do? And it's why you're here, actually, this evening, why you've come to this meeting. It's not just to hear those of us who speak a lot on public platforms, but actually to say, where do I engage? And I think that there is now an opportunity, whether it's informing yourself on fair trade, you know, the kind of commodities that you buy, the child labour issues, the website, the internet is a huge opportunity. If you're interested in children, have a look at the work that's been done, see where you can be supportive and be informed. The important thing is to get engaged, because the common enemy is indifference. It's this terrible two worlds that we live in. And I do want to say something very briefly about the United States. It is extraordinarily important that the United States engage in the issues of bridging the divides, and we have identified some priorities in the Millennium Development Goals. As I mentioned, there is huge concern about the poor implementation. Certainly talking to audiences in the United States, I know that if I mention the Millennium Declaration, Millennium Development Goals, I'll get blank faces. There has been no political awareness raising, and so that is also a huge task. But having said that, it is, coming back in a sort of sentence of kind of framing as to where we are, we had the major world conferences in the 90s, and they did provide us with agendas which would be very valuable if we really seriously implement them. We have the narrowing of that to the Millennium Development Goals with their timeline of 2015. To the question asked about, well, we don't have the resources. We do. We have the resources. We are the generation that has the resources to close the gaps in our world. The costings for implementation of the Millennium Development Goals by 2015 was done by Ernesto Zedillo and other economists at the Conference on Financing for Development in Monterey, and it was an additional approximately $50 billion of global development assistance. I thought at the time that that was a very large figure, but now I'm hearing these figures for over $800 billion of one country, the largest country, mind you, in military spending. The cost per month of the maintenance of a military presence in Iraq and so on. These figures, $50 billion US, additional US dollars, is not a major sum if we were really committed to the enormous gain in human security. And that is where I think we have to convince the United States in particular, but the developed world in general. We cannot have human security when our world is so divided. The world sees the other half. That's part of the interconnections that we have of communications. In the poorest places that I've been in of terrible poverty, you usually see one satellite dish. It won't be in every home, but somebody in the street or in the and people go together and watch this other world. And there is that sense of the frustrations of the divide. So the message, I think, is do get engaged. If you've come here this evening, don't go away saying, well, there's nothing I can do. There is. There's plenty you can do, and by God, there's plenty to do.
Well, that is a thank you. It remains for me, just on that very elegant note, to thank the panel again and to once again express our appreciation. So many thanks.
Thank you.